Good evening. I'm Judy Woodruff on the NewsHour tonight, the aftermath. The value of so-called red flag laws for gun buyers is under scrutiny following revelations that the suspected Highland Park shooter passed multiple background checks. Then a leader in crisis. UK Prime Minister Boris Johnson remains defiant in the face of mounting calls to resign after several of his top advisors quit. And at the extreme, Phoenix seeks ways to offset rapidly rising temperatures that pose a major health risk to its most vulnerable residents.
Individuals experiencing homelessness in Maricopa County are at about 200 times higher risk of suffering heat-associated illness or death than folks who have regular stable housing.
All that and more on tonight's PBS NewsHour. An Illinois state judge denied bail today for the gunman who police say confessed to the July 4th massacre in Highland Park that left seven people dead. Authorities revealed that the gunman considered starting another shooting spree in Madison, Wisconsin, where he drove while he was avoiding police in Illinois. And there were more questions about how he was able to get his guns in the first place. Amna Nawaz has the latest.
Today, in a closed hearing, the first court appearance for the 21-year-old alleged gunman behind Monday's attack, charged with killing seven people and injuring more than three dozen at a July 4th parade in Highland Park, Illinois.
The judge ruled that Robert Cremo III would be held without bond and that there was probable cause to hold him at this time for seven counts of first-degree murder.
Most plan was
Deputy Chief Christopher Covelli of the Lake County Sheriff's Office shared new details of Cremo's plans as he fled to Wisconsin after the shooting.
However, he did see a celebration that was occurring in Madison, and he seriously contemplated using the firearm he had in his vehicle to commit another shooting.
Covelli said the gunman had about 60 rounds left at that point, but hadn't planned enough to carry out a second attack. The Highland Park attack, however, had been planned for several weeks. He'd legally purchased five guns, including the Smith & Wesson semi-automatic rifle used in the shooting, which was bought in Illinois in the last year. That despite two encounters with police in 2019, one after he attempted suicide, the second after he threatened to kill family, leading officers to confiscate 16 knives, a dagger, and sword from the home. There were no charges or arrests in either case. Authorities recovered 83 spent bullet shells from the rooftop where Cremo took aim at parade goers. Investigators are still reviewing the gunman's social media posts and conducting interviews to determine a motive. Meanwhile, another American community grieves. Authorities today identified the seventh victim as Eduardo Uvaldo, a 69-year-old grandfather. And Highland Park's loss ripples far beyond this neighborhood. Among yesterday's visitors, Vice President Kamala Harris, meeting with first responders and local leaders at the parade site. Officials say nine people, ranging from ages 14 to 70, are still hospitalized as of yesterday.
Let's focus now on some of the questions being raised about how the gunman was able to obtain weapons after those 2019 incidents and what red flag laws can and cannot do. Jeffrey Swanson studies these issues. He's a professor of psychiatry and behavioral sciences at Duke University who looks closely at shootings. Professor Swanson, welcome back to the NewsHour. Thank you for joining us. I want to ask you about these details we're learning. Here you have a young man who was twice flagged to authorities. He was still able to get a firearm owner's ID card. He passed background checks. He legally bought his weapons. Illinois has a red flag law on the books. Why didn't it work?
Well, it is concerning. Warning signs always look more obvious and worse when we view them through this remarkable device called a retrospectoscope. When we're looking forward, there are a lot of people who have contacts with law enforcement, a lot of people who look like they should, they pose a risk of harm to self or others. So, yes, and if people see something like this, if people, somebody around you is of concern, you should take action in calling the police. In this case, it's what they did. The question is, what can the police actually do? The red flag law is designed to give police officer's authority to remove firearms. It's a civil restraining order. It's someone who poses a risk, usually it's an imminent risk of harm to self or others. They can remove those guns with a court order, and it's time limited. But otherwise, there's not much they can do. If the person poses a risk in a mental health crisis, police officers have the authority to take that person in, detain them for usually about 72 hours for an evaluation. And if they meet the criteria, if they're dangerous and mentally ill, they can be admitted involuntarily to a hospital to mitigate that risk. That would have conferred a gun disqualifying record. The red flag law can work, but if people don't know about it, don't know how to use it, there's no protocol in place, it's not routine, it's not scaled up to where officers or others know to use it, it's not going to do much good anyway.
Well, as you say, of course, things are much clearer in hindsight, but there are some details I want to ask you about, because from a law enforcement perspective now, we now know that they went to the home twice. They took away knives, a dagger, and a sword after the family said that this young man threatened to kill everyone there. They were told he was getting mental health support, but then they say the family didn't want to move forward with a complaint. They didn't have any other information on threats. And even though local police flagged state police, that's basically it. That's all they can do. So is the bar for what law enforcement can do at the right place?
I don't want to second guess what the police did in this case. It could well be that they should have done more, they should have done something differently. It's a real challenge in our country when firearms are so prevalent. What we need is an ensemble of laws. The red flag law is a good tool. It's a kind of a like a Swiss Army knife, it's a nimble tool because we don't have to decide why somebody's dangerous at the time, but they have to be dangerous, pose a risk during a particular time frame. Red flag laws would work better if we had universal background checks, if we did something about, the illegal gun market in this country and the fact that young people and or anybody for that matter can buy a weapon of war that is designed to kill multiple people in a very short period of time with minimal physical effort. So this is a real puzzle. Red flag laws, I still maintain, are a very important tool if people know about them and if they are widely used. We have evidence from Connecticut and Indiana, the first two states that enacted similar laws, that for every 10 to 20 of these legal actions, one life is saved by averting a suicide. That's what many of them are used for. And we have emerging evidence to show that in many cases in California and in other states, a significant proportion of these are used when there is a threat of a mass shooting. We don't know in every case that it would have happened without this, but we do know that if these are used in a timely way, it's going to remove a key element in one of these horrible incidents. Other countries have troubled young men who are inclined to hurt people or saying scary things on social media. They don't have this problem that we have, where there's this very deviant cultural script that's almost uniquely American that people follow. But a key element in that is this access to very lethal weapons.
That is Professor Jeffrey Swanson of Duke University joining us tonight. Professor Swanson, thank you for joining us again.
Thank you for having me.
As we said, seven people have died in this tragic shooting. We want to take a moment now to remember the victims and the lives they led.
Father of eight, Nicholas Toledo Zaragoza, traveled to Highland Park from Mexico to visit family. His granddaughter remembered her abuelito as loving and creative. What was supposed to be a fun family day turned into a horrific nightmare for us all. As a family, we are broken and numb. Nicholas was 78. Kevin McCarthy, 37, and Irina McCarthy, 35, were at the parade with their two-year-old son, Aiden, who survived and was brought to safety by Good Samaritans hoping to reunite him with his parents. On the family's GoFundMe page, it reads, "Aiden will have a long road ahead to heal, find stability, and ultimately navigate life as an orphan." 64-year-old Catherine Goldstein was a beloved mother and wife to husband Craig. Her eldest daughter, Cassie, was with her mom at the parade. She spoke to NBC's Lester Holt about the attack.
I told her that it was a shooter and that she had to run. So I started running with her, and we were next to each other. And he shot her in the chest, and she fell down, and I knew she was dead. So I just told her that I loved her, but I couldn't stop because he was still shooting everyone next to me.
Highland Park resident Stephen Strauss, 88, still took the train every day from Highland Park to Chicago, where he worked at a brokerage firm. His wife told reporters he was an honorable man who worked his whole life and looked out for his family and gave everyone the best he had. Jacqueline Sundheim was a former preschool teacher and events planner at her synagogue, North Shore Congregation Israel, of which she was a lifelong member. In a statement, North Shore said, "Jackie's work, kindness, and warmth touched us all. There are no words sufficient to express the depth of our grief." Jackie was 63. Eduardo Uvaldo, 69, was pronounced dead at the hospital this morning. His granddaughter, Nivia, wrote on the family's GoFundMe page, "Unfortunately, my grandpa got shot in the arm, then in the back of the head. My grandpa is a kind, loving, and funny man who did not deserve this."
And our hearts go out to the loved ones of all those who've passed away. And one more note, the GoFundMe page for Aiden McCarthy, who is 2, has raised more than $2.5 million since it was launched yesterday. In the day's other news, former Trump White House counsel Pat Cipollone has agreed to testify this week before the House committee investigating the January 6th attack. Cipollone is believed to be a crucial witness to what went on in the West Wing in the days surrounding the Capitol siege. He's expected to appear on Friday under subpoena for a closed-door transcribed interview. A new report out today from Texas State University details a string of missed opportunities to stop the elementary school massacre in Uvalde, Texas, in May. Among them, a police officer armed with a rifle missed his chance to shoot the gunman because he was waiting for his supervisor's permission. The report also said that some of the 21 victims could have been saved if they were given medical attention sooner. President Biden spoke by phone today with the wife of U.S. pro basketball star Brittany Griner, who's on trial in Russia for drug smuggling. White House officials said he assured Sherelle Griner that he's working to secure her wife's release as soon as possible. Meanwhile, the Russian foreign ministry now says that Griner can appeal her sentence or ask for clemency once a verdict is delivered. Her next court hearing is scheduled for tomorrow. In Ukraine, government officials say that a renewed Russian onslaught on towns and cities in the east has left at least 8 people dead and dozens more wounded. Overnight, Russian missiles flattened a university in Kharkiv. Ukraine had forced Russian troops out of Ukraine's second-largest city earlier in the war. The United Nations released a grim report today on the rise of world hunger, calling it a looming catastrophe. It found that around 2.3 billion people faced moderate or severe difficulty getting enough to eat in 2021. The data was collected before the war in Ukraine, which has threatened further starvation. At least 77 people have now died in monsoon rains across Pakistan over the past 3 weeks. The deluge has flooded huge swaths in the southwestern part of the country, leaving shell-shocked residents to pick up the pieces.
"We lost 6 members of our families. We lost our houses. We lost everything. After a big struggle, we recovered bodies of our loved ones. Now we don't have food for our children. We are out in the open sky waiting for government aid."
Pakistan's Minister for Climate Change said that this year's monsoon rains have been nearly 90% heavier than average. More than 400 inmates in Nigeria are still at large after a jailbreak in the capital city. Explosions rang out late last night at a maximum security prison in Abuja. The Islamic State claimed responsibility. Around half of the nearly 900 prisoners who fled have now been captured. On the pandemic, the FDA announced U.S. pharmacists can now prescribe Paxlovid, that's the leading COVID treatment pill, directly to patients. Meanwhile, overseas, Beijing and Shanghai ramped up their COVID testing again after a spike in new cases. Some worry that China could reimpose restrictions just weeks after emerging from a strict lockdown. Back in this country, President Biden touted his plan to rescue pensions for millions of workers during a visit to Cleveland, Ohio. He said that the American Rescue Plan will help underfunded multi-employer pensions remain solvent at least through 2051, so workers won't see their benefits cut despite the economic crisis.
This 4th of July, let's remember who is the backbone of this country. It's you. The American worker. I promised you I'd be the most pro-labor, pro-union, pro-worker president of history, and there's another promise I'm going to be keeping as well.
The White House said workers and retirees in some 200 multi-employer pension plans were at risk of not receiving the full benefits they earned before the federal government took action. And stocks climbed higher on Wall Street today as minutes from the Federal Reserve's last policy meeting reaffirmed their commitment to tackle inflation. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 70 points to close at 31,037. The NASDAQ rose 39 points, and the S&P 500 added 13. Still to come on the NewsHour, how abortion providers are adjusting to their new reality post-Roe. Legal battles over past and future elections heat up in Georgia and Arizona. Conservationists work to protect endangered species in Iraq, plus much more.
This is the PBS NewsHour from WETA Studios in Washington and in the West from the Walter Cronkite School of Journalism at Arizona State University.
In a year of mostly self-inflicted political wounds for Britain's Prime Minister Boris Johnson, dozens of members of his government resigned yesterday and today over how he handled allegations of sexual harassment by a former aide. It began with his health and treasury secretaries, but amid deafening cries for him to step down, Johnson is defiant. Romilly Weeks of Independent Television News reports from London.
If you can measure the trouble you're in by the number of cameras stationed outside your front door, the Prime Minister only had to glance out of the window to know he's in very serious straits indeed.
Is it all over, Prime Minister?
A defiant wave as he left the Prime Minister's questions, but to ever-increasing numbers in his party, he's a leader who's run out of answers. As his convoy headed into Parliament, the resignations from his government continued to roll in. His greatest danger now, not the delighted benches opposite him, but the frozen faces of the party behind him. Characteristic of him that he tried to make light of it.
This morning, Mr. Speaker, I had meetings with ministerial colleagues and others. In addition to my duties in this House, I expect I shall have further such meetings later today.
But that laughter soon died with this.
What a pathetic spectacle. Exactly. The dying act of his political career is to parrot that nonsense. Yep. And as for those who are left, only in office because no one else is prepared to debase themselves any longer, the charge of the lightweight brigade.
The faces of the remaining loyalists on his front bench showing they were not enjoying the line of attack. And then one after the other, his own backbenchers wielded the knife.
Does the Prime Minister think there are any circumstances in which he should resign?
Today, I ask him to do the honourable thing.
Take responsibility and resign.
Frankly, Mr. Speaker, the job of a Prime Minister in difficult circumstances when he's been handed a colossal mandate is to keep going, and that's what I'm going to do.
Morning, Mr. Javid.
The man who started it all looked pretty buoyant as he left to tell everyone why he'd had to go.
Treading the tightrope between loyalty and integrity has become impossible in recent months. And, Mr. Speaker, I will never risk losing my integrity. And now this week again, we have reason to question the truth and integrity of what we've all been told. And at some point, we have to conclude that enough is enough.
The Prime Minister looked into the middle distance. The expressions on the faces of his party reflected a grimmer story. As well as the ticking tally of resignations, the letters of no confidence in the Prime Minister's leadership are piling up. His next date with destiny, facing a committee of MPs, where 8 out of the 9 Tories questioning him had already withdrawn their support.
Prime Minister, how's your week going?
Terrific. Like many others.
The cornered Prime Minister has made it clear he'll have to be forced out of Number 10. Behind this door, his cabinet might be about to try.
That report from Romilly Weeks of Independent Television News. It's been almost 2 weeks since the Supreme Court overturned the 5-decade-old landmark abortion rights decision, Roe v. Wade. In that short time, doctors and abortion providers have been left to navigate different state-by-state laws while still trying to provide care for their patients. Stephanie Tsai has more.
In this post-Roe world, physicians in states with near total abortion bans are having to wade through medically and ethically murky waters. In Texas, for example, a law set to go into effect makes all abortions illegal, including in cases of rape and incest. The only exception is to keep a woman from dying. But what does that mean in practice? To help us understand, I'm joined by Dr. Ghazala Moyeti, an OBGYN in Texas who had offered abortion care as part of her practice. Dr. Moyeti, thank you so much for joining the NewsHour. I want to jump right in here. In Texas, the law says if a doctor sees, quote, substantial impairment of bodily function during a pregnancy, they can legally provide an abortion. But couldn't that mean something different to every doctor? And what are the ramifications of that?
Exactly, Stephanie. There isn't one type of medical complication where you say, okay, this is life-threatening and this isn't. In practice, what that means is that every single person will be faced with different hospitals, different physicians, different nurses that will make different decisions depending on the day. And that is catastrophic to the health and well-being of pregnant people in our state.
Dr. Moyeti, in the recent article you co-authored that was published in the New England Journal of Medicine, you interviewed dozens of clinicians in Texas, and you wrote, quote, patients with pregnancy complications or pre-existing medical conditions that may be exacerbated by pregnancy are being forced to delay an abortion until their conditions become life-threatening. Do you think that some doctors are already waiting until a woman's vital signs are in distress where she is near dying before they feel they are legally covered to provide an abortion?
Yes, that's exactly what we saw in the research that we conducted and exactly what I've been hearing from my colleagues across the state, that people will come in the early second trimester with their bag of water broken. This is a pregnancy complication that, let's say at 18 weeks, cannot be saved, but they are being told that they need to go home and wait until they have a fever, wait until they start hemorrhaging, or wait until they show signs of sepsis before they can return to have an abortion. And that is, we saw that through our study, and I'm hearing that from colleagues all across the state in that setting.
Another complication that can happen in pregnancy, and one of the most dangerous, is an ectopic pregnancy when a fertilized egg implants outside the uterus. This is, in theory, excluded from the abortion ban in Texas, but what are you hearing in practice is happening in that instance?
Exactly. Even an ectopic pregnancy, which seemingly is excluded, falls into a gray area which can be interpreted differently depending on where the person shows up. So most commonly, an ectopic pregnancy might implant in the fallopian tubes or in the ovaries, but an ectopic pregnancy can also implant into a C-section scar or into a uterine scar from a prior surgery. That pregnancy will then grow through the uterine scar, potentially outside of the uterus and into the bladder. even before this ban went into effect, there were hospitals in Texas that would refuse to care for someone with an ectopic in the C-section scar because they weren't sure if it was actually an ectopic or not. And so what we are seeing now is that more and more people are being denied care for these gray areas that are not as clear cut because that decision making is very individualized. It can't be clearly defined in a law. This is a complication and this is not a complication. This is near death and this is not near death. That is very individual.
In all the cases you've described so far, we're talking about the life of the mother. What about those mothers that are carrying fetuses with diagnosed fatal abnormalities, genetic abnormalities, where they know that once they have the baby, that the baby's lifespan is limited?
Yes, unfortunately, none of these laws in our state have any exceptions for lethal fetal diagnosis. And so what we have seen over the past 10 months is that people that are diagnosed with lethal fetal conditions, for example, like anencephaly, where the brain doesn't grow, or renal agenesis, where there are no kidneys, there is not a potential for life after birth. And yet pregnant people are forced to endure a complete pregnancy and the risks that come with that. And we have to remember, Texas has one of the highest maternal mortality rates in the country, even more so for Black women in our state. And so this disproportionately puts Black people, people of color, at risk of maternal death without any benefit or potential chance for a live birth.
And we know that the United States as a whole has a higher maternal mortality rate than other nations of equal affluence. If a doctor or a hospital does make a decision to not provide an abortion and that leads to a woman's or a girl's death, what accountability do they have under the law?
You know, that will remain to be seen. I strongly believe that our duty is to our community and to our patients, and we have to act through that moral compass, the ethical duty we have to care for people and to save their lives. But how this is going to turn out from a medical legal standpoint is going to be determined by the courts. And that is the even more terrifying part for all of us as pregnant people, as pregnant capable people, as moms, and as Americans.
Dr. Ghazala Moyeti, an OBGYN in Texas, thank you for joining the NewsHour.
Thank you for having me.
Most states have by now held their party primaries for this year's elections, but many are still dealing with the fallout of the 2020 presidential election. That includes investigations into efforts to overturn the 2020 results and challenges to new election laws. Lisa Desjardins is here with an update.
This election year, just like in 2020, all eyes are on a handful of key battleground states. That's where we turn our focus with two reporters covering the story. Stephen Fowler is a political reporter for Georgia Public Broadcasting, and Andrew Oxford is a reporter at Arizona Public Media. Let's start in Georgia with you, Stephen Fowler, and let's look at the list of people subpoenaed just yesterday in the Fulton County grand jury investigation of the 2020 election. You see their top Trump officials like attorney Rudy Giuliani, some allies like then Judiciary Chairman Lindsey Graham, others involved in a phone call to state officials from President Trump and others. Stephen Fowler, what do you think these subpoenas mean and what do they tell us about this case?
Well, it sends a pretty clear message about what the special grand jury and Fulton County District Attorney Fani Willis are looking for as they continue to investigate efforts to overturn the 2020 election in Georgia. Much of the figures that have been subpoenaed appeared at a December 2020 unofficial hearing of the Georgia State Legislature where nobody was under oath, nobody was compelled to tell the truth, and a lot of falsehoods were shared about Georgia's election, particularly vote counting in Fulton County's State Farm Arena. And there were several video clips that were played that turned out to be debunked, but the people in these subpoenas still push those claims, and that's some of what the investigators are looking at.
We already know Senator Lindsey Graham of South Carolina, for example, has said he is not going to cooperate with this subpoena. He calls this politics. What do we know about what's ahead here in this fight and the timeline in this case?
Well, it is moving relatively quickly. The special grand jury was impaneled in May. They've been hearing from testimony from everyone from Republican Secretary of State Brad Raffensperger to Democratic state lawmakers that were present in those hearings. And much like what we're seeing in Washington, D.C. with the January 6th committee hearings, prosecutors and the grand jury are building things from the ground up, a very foundational level investigation into many of the claims made, many potential crimes that were committed, and we could see this accelerate rapidly.
All right, let's move west. Subpoenas also in Arizona just last week, where you are, Andrew Oxford. We've seen these Republican officials subpoenaed last week, this time by the FBI. We see our two state senators, Karen Fann and Kelly Townsend, be subpoenaed. Tell us, who are these lawmakers, and what is the FBI looking for here?
Karen Fann is the leader of the state Senate. She's a Republican from Prescott, and Kelly Townsend is a Republican from the Mesa area, from Apache Junction. And Kelly Townsend told 12 News here in Arizona that the subpoena she received was seeking communications between her and Trump's lawyers. We already know, of course, that Trump's attorneys like Rudy Giuliani were in touch with leading Arizona lawmakers after the 2020 election, as lawmakers either joined calls or faced mounting calls to overturn the results of the presidential election here. In fact, Senate President Karen Fann told a constituent in December 2020 in an email that she'd had multiple conversations with Rudy Giuliani. So I think it'll be interesting to see if these subpoenas reveal anything new about that sort of communication, about the pressure campaign that lawmakers were facing or participating in. President Fann has downplayed the significance of this subpoena, though she said that it's seeking documents and communications that others have already requested through public records laws.
This is all a lot to keep track of. We've just talked about different investigations about the election, but there at the same time is a lawsuit now in your state in Arizona. The Department of Justice is suing the state over its new election law. And to remind viewers, the law isn't all that simple, but here are some of the points that the Justice Department is looking at, that the law would require voters to bring documents proving citizenship. They would have to check a citizenship box and fill in their place of birth. Andrew, help us out. What is the legal back and forth over this law?
Right. So Arizona already requires voters to provide proof of citizenship when they register. If they don't, they still have a right, of course, to cast a ballot in federal elections, to vote for president, to vote for members of Congress. This new law, passed on a party line vote in the legislature earlier this year and signed by Governor Ducey, requires election officials to verify the citizenship of those voters who haven't provided proof of citizenship. And it says that if you don't provide proof of citizenship, you can't vote for president and you can't vote by mail. The Department of Justice says that this violates the National Voting Rights Act. The U.S. Supreme Court has actually already taken up a similar policy in Arizona about a decade ago in a case here. So, in fact, staff at the legislature have warned that the legislature would likely end up in this position of facing challenges to this law. In committee hearings, as lawmakers are debating it, attorneys warned that this could violate federal law. As one lawmaker said, though, they believe this is a fight worth having. And I think it's perhaps worth looking at this whole back and forth as really an effort by some Republican lawmakers to challenge broader national voting rights laws.
To wrap this all up, I want to ask both of you. You're there on the ground. You've been watching and covering how your state votes and the controversy around how your states have voted. I want to start with you, Stephen, but ask both of you, where do things stand right now?
Well, Georgia's election law has been challenged. Numerous different lawsuits have been filed for the different parts of the 98-page law that we had here. And so far, it's been a slow-moving process. We did just recently have a federal judge deny a preliminary injunction to block part of Georgia's law dealing with third-party absentee ballot applications. But, Lisa, we are running up close to a time when federal courts don't normally like to change election laws because we have preparations happening very, very soon for the November race. So it's unlikely that Georgia's election laws will change any time before voters head to the polls.
Andrew, what about in Arizona?
I think we'll get a good sense of that next month when Republican primary voters have some really big choices to make about who they want to elevate to or nominate for election officials, the Secretary of State's race, for example, a key role in setting election policy and running the state's elections. You have a candidate running on his endorsement from Donald Trump, and candidates trying to strike a more moderate tone. Even at local levels, I think you'll see Republican primary voters weighing in about the direction they want not just the state to go, but how they want elections to be run into the future here. Rusty Bowers, the House Speaker who was testifying in front of the January 6th committee, is running for state senate and has a primary challenger who is touting his support for Donald Trump. So you'll see, I think, a pretty good indication of which way the base of the party wants to go here in the coming month.
Stephen Fowler and Andrew Oxford are expert reporters on the ground. We thank both of you.
Last year set a record for heat-related deaths in the United States, and this year is already shaping up to be worse in terms of high temperatures. Stephanie Tsai is back now with this report from Phoenix in Maricopa County, Arizona, which has been at the center of heat-related deaths, and where rising homelessness in recent years is making even more people vulnerable to extreme heat.
Clay Hatfield has been living in this tent on a sidewalk in downtown Phoenix for the last 3 months. He's 69.
So I keep the table covered with a towel so that the table doesn't get hot. And I got towels I'll put over the chair so it doesn't get hot. Try to cut down all the radiant heat that I can.
When we visited him in early June, it got up to 100 degrees, and he was bracing for hotter days to come. But you can only weatherproof a tent so much.
I'm not going to get it to a comfortable level. What I'm hoping to do is achieve a livable level. 110 is going to kill me. 90 I can live with.
Have you thought about going to a shelter during the summer months?
Well, here's the problem with the shelters is at about 5 or 6 o'clock in the morning, you have to leave the shelter. So then, in the hot, miserable time of the day, you're out on the street with nowhere to go. I tried it and it was miserable.
There is somewhere he can go. His tent is just a few hundred yards from a daytime center for homeless seniors. Even a short walk in this heat can scald the soles of your shoes. At the Justice Center, Hatfield can get a meal and a cold shower.
If I wasn't able to come here and sit and get water and just cool off and stay out of the heat, I wouldn't make it because I'm that sensitive to the heat.
Wouldn't be able to make it is not hyperbole. The elderly and unhoused are among the most vulnerable to heat-related illness and death. But Deborah Hernandez has the added risk factor of a serious heart condition.
I'm extremely concerned because I've already passed out once just from the heat, and I was not in the direct sun.
She only recently became homeless.
The house that I was living in, I was renting, was sold. I was hit by a drunk driver, so I lost my car. I went and rented a hotel room. I was paying up $2,200 a month just for a hotel room.
As she waits for the insurance claim on her wrecked car to be paid, she's just trying to survive her first summer without housing. Heat is an annual emergency here. The firefighters and paramedics in Phoenix, who we spent a few June afternoons with, frequently respond to heat distress calls, says Captain Chris Marini.
On those days where you mix it in with not drinking, not having proper nutrition, and then also, you know, possibly alcohol or drugs, it's real easy where people, you know, just become, you know, altered, and now they can't take care of themselves, and they just start overheating real fast.
In recent years, the homeless have accounted for about half of the total deaths associated with heat in Maricopa County. 2020 was a screaming alarm for officials here. One of the state's driest and hottest summers on record was also its deadliest. Over 520 deaths linked to heat, twice the number of fatalities reported nationally from all other natural disasters combined.
How are we doing this morning?
I'm fine, 35.
Feeling okay? I see you got some shade there.
Yeah, I got
In response, the city of Phoenix created a new office, appointing health and climate scientist David Handula as a sort of heat czar. It's the first publicly funded position of its kind in the country.
The heat illness statistics would suggest that in general, we are not meeting the need yet for heat relief in our community. We've seen increasing numbers of heat-associated deaths, a 400% increase since 2014.
Soon after taking the job, Handula realized that he can't solve heat deaths without addressing homelessness.
Our best estimate is that individuals experiencing homelessness in Maricopa County are at about 200 times higher risk of suffering heat-associated illness or death than folks who have regular stable housing.
And while having outreach workers hand out water and sunscreen can't hurt, Handula says those and even the cooling centers are only band-aids.
We need to be thinking about housing affordability. We need to be thinking about drug and alcohol rehabilitation and recovery. We need to be thinking about just simply more shelters for folks in the city.
Climate change models say Phoenix should expect more super hot days.
The projections suggest that our hottest days are days that are in the 115 to 120 degree range right now, could become 4, 5, 6, 7 degrees Fahrenheit hotter over the next several decades. That's, of course, a great concern because those hottest days are absolutely the most dangerous.
In Phoenix, they're also piloting new technologies to try to lower the temperatures in these neighborhoods. They've begun spraying a reflective coating on certain city streets. Early data shows that the temperature on this surface is considerably lower than on traditional asphalt.
We could actually wind up with a Phoenix of the future that's cooler than the one we have today, even if global warming continues. So that gives us motivation to invest in and experiment with technologies like cool pavement that our street transportation department is applying. We have more miles of cool pavement here than any other city in North America.
But the low-tech tactic that may make the biggest impact is planting more trees. Leafy trees not only provide shade, the water they take in, for example, through the city's flood irrigation system, is given back as moisture and cooling to the air, a process called evapotranspiration.
The trees we're planting here, most of them are native to the Sonoran Desert.
At Borman Elementary School in West Phoenix, Joaquin Murrieta, a cultural ecologist, is helping out at a tree planting event run by a group of local NGOs.
Imagine when it rains in Phoenix, water, where does it go? It's a lot of water that flows on the streets, so we can guide that water to rain gardens along the streets with basins that will hold that water, with native plants, with native trees. So eventually we can transform our city to be a green city.
Amy Esposito of the Phoenix-based group Trees Matter says planting canopy in underserved communities and schools should be a priority.
We're trying to address where we plant trees from an equity standpoint, and so we're looking at where do we plant trees where trees are not currently invested in as much.
You don't have to look far to see that socioeconomically disadvantaged neighborhoods have less shade compared to more affluent areas. Phoenix's city council recently allocated $6 million of leftover COVID rescue money to fund tree planting. But David Handula's heat office is fighting an uphill battle with urban development. Phoenix is one of the fastest growing cities in the country. It's already what experts call a heat island, where the lack of shade combined with heat absorbing asphalt can make it 10 degrees warmer than surrounding areas.
You're trying to build a heat-resistant metropolis in the middle of Sonoran Desert. Is that even realistic?
When we look at what climate models suggest we can do with our built environment, when we think about technologies that are becoming available, when we're thinking about low-hanging fruit in terms of how we might be able to just nudge behaviors a little bit to be safer in our heat, we think there's a lot of opportunity ahead for how this can be a thriving, sustainable city decades and centuries into the future.
But that kind of transformation will take decades of investment and political will. For now, the need for cooling centers has grown so much that faith-based organizations are needed to help meet demand. The Justice Center depends on donations.
What does the cooling center mean for your daily life during the summer?
I wouldn't have survived without it.
Here, charity means not only feeding the poor and giving them water to drink, but providing air-conditioned refuge from the relentless summer heat. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Stephanie Tsai in Phoenix.
Iraq finds itself in the news usually due to violence and conflict. But the country also boasts a rich natural environment, spanning jagged mountains in the north to pristine deserts in the south, offering a habitat to 84 endangered species. Wildlife conservationists are trying to strengthen laws and raise awareness to save these animals from extinction. Special correspondent Simona Foltin begins her report in the Karadagh Mountains of northern Iraq.
We're following Hannah Ahmed Raza on her arduous journey in pursuit of the Persian leopard, one of the 17 endangered mammals in Iraq. Scrambling across the rugged terrain and accompanied by forest police, the wildlife conservationist is trying to locate one of over 30 motion sensor cameras set up 3 months ago to photograph the elusive cats.
So for today, we're going to pick up two camera traps, and then we will check and see if we were successful in trapping a leopard or not.
The Persian leopard once roamed large parts of Iraq, from the mountains in the north to the lowlands further south. It was thought to have gone extinct as a result of decades of war, hunting, and the gradual destruction of its natural habitat. Then in 2011, Hannah's camera traps, strapped to oak trees along hidden forest paths, first photographed the rare predator. She has since been working on a population estimate. But while these remote border areas offer refuge to the leopard, they also pose challenges for those trying to conserve it.
Sometimes the governments get suspicious about the use of the cameras we use. There's a lot of paperwork that, you know, needs to happen in order for us to conduct camera trapping and field work.
Add to that the physical risk of accessing this previously war-afflicted region.
There's a lot of minefields that stops us from going into the mountains freely and set up camera traps.
Hannah believes around two dozen mostly male Persian leopards live in the Kurdish mountains of northern Iraq, sustained by a larger breeding population across the border in Iran. To map and protect the migration corridors used by the animals, she collaborates with Iranian conservationists. But the project came to a sudden halt in 2018 after her Iranian counterparts were arrested and later convicted for spying, most likely because they used camera traps.
The animals that we study are already facing a lot of threat. When the conservationists are imprisoned, right now in Iran, there's no one in the field to work on protecting these animals.
Back at the car, Hannah flicks through the pictures taken by the camera we just recovered. There are photos of wild goats, rangers patrolling, but no leopard.
That's it. Nothing. I had great hopes for this one, actually.
That's disappointing.
Yeah. It's very, very disappointing.
Still more setbacks are to come. Hannah sets off to recover the second camera, but returns empty-handed. The camera was stolen, likely by hunters who fear it could expose them.
This is actually the second time my cameras are stolen in this particular area of the mountain. So, and then as we were coming down, I actually saw two hunters.
Hunting in Kurdistan is forbidden except for two bird species and the hare. But the rangers are too under-resourced, too thinly spread to enforce regulations. Oil exploration here in the Karadagh Mountains risks further hampering conservation efforts.
For 4 years, conservationists have lobbied authorities to designate Karadagh as a nature reserve for the Persian leopard. But the process has been hampered by red tape, the lack of adequate legislation, as well as urgency on the part of the regional government, which is grappling with a myriad of political, economic, and security issues.
To catch a glimpse of the Persian leopard, we had to visit the zoo in nearby Duhok. This six-year-old male recently lost his hind leg when he fell into a trap set by local farmers. Wildlife vet and conservationist Dr. Suleiman Tamir had no choice but to amputate the injured leg. The leopard now faces a lifetime in captivity, but Dr. Suleiman hopes the animal could still prove useful for conservation efforts.
Because it's like a rare species of animal here, and it's for scientific or for research is very good. Maybe it's good we do like some, we keep some semen, or we can do some like artificial insemination, or we increase some reproductive for our new generation.
Illegal hunting is not just threatening wildlife in Iraqi Kurdistan. It is wiping out ever-shrinking populations of endangered species across the country, including here in Iraq's southern deserts bordering Saudi Arabia. We joined a group of local hunters looking for the Asian Hubara bustard, a migratory bird that spends the winters in Iraq.
In the past, the quantity of the Hubara was much more than the current year. But because of the large number of hunters, the number of birds has gone down.
The Hubara is a prized bird that can sell for hundreds of dollars. It's traditionally hunted with the help of falcons. Many of the falconers flooding these deserts during the cooler winter months are not Iraqis, but hunting delegations from nearby Gulf countries like Qatar or Kuwait. Their presence injects much-needed money into the local economy.
The people here work as guides with the visitors from the Gulf countries. Also, the visitors buy sheep, food and vegetables from the market, fuel for their cars, and all of these things benefit the local community, which is good.
But others are concerned that overhunting is quickly depleting the already scarce natural resources of these barren deserts.
They overhunt and waste the desert animal population, such as the hare, the hobara, and other birds. They hunt for entertainment.
The men say that the Iraqi government has encouraged hunting delegations from Gulf countries, with whom Prime Minister Mustafa al-Kadhimi has sought to strengthen diplomatic and economic ties. But in Baghdad, officials at the Ministry of Environment say hunting of the Hubara remains strictly forbidden, and that permissions are granted through personal connections rather than official channels.
They have the permissions, sure. But who authorized them? I don't know. They apply for it through the governorate, that they are willing to come and spend money, and the governor accepts.
Just like in Iraqi Kurdistan to the north, the environmental police don't have the resources to enforce the law. The result is that it has become nearly impossible to spot a Hubara. Early morning, we set out with Issa Jabbar to try our luck.
See those fissures and bushes over there? That's where the Hubara likes to hide.
But there's no trace of the bird this morning.
See, there's nothing crossing in this track. I can only see footprints for the fox, but no Hubara.
Rising temperatures and desertification are putting further pressure on endangered species, gradually eroding precious habitat. But both climate change and conservation rank low on the government's list of priorities, leaving conservationists alone in their uphill battle to preserve Iraq's wildlife. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Simona Foltin in the north and south of Iraq.
So rare to get that kind of report. We are so grateful. And that is the NewsHour for tonight. I'm Judy Woodruff. Join us online and again here tomorrow evening for all of us at the PBS NewsHour. Thank you. Please stay safe, and we'll see you soon.